Thank you very much, Jonathan. Thanks again for inviting me to speak on a topic that is very close to my heart. You know, once you've been involved in this important thing, it's even for a diplomat who gets moved around very often, not easy to just let it go and move on to other things. I would like to speak to you today and have a little speech without any presentation. You know, I'm not a professor, or I used to be one, but not anymore. That's a privilege of a diplomat just to speak as they do in the halls. We do not do any PowerPoint presentations during negotiations. So that's my model. So I ask you to listen. And then, of course, I'm at your disposal for all sorts of questions, and I'm hopeful that we're going to have an interesting discussion afterwards. I want to split my presentation in four parts. Part one, what is Copenhagen? Part two, what is the problem? Part three, what happened so far? And part four, what are the options for the outcome? Now, what is Copenhagen? Copenhagen is not the World Climate Conference as you read it in the papers. Copenhagen is basically three things. First of all, it's United Nations Framework Convention's 15th Conference of the Parties. Secondly, it's the fifth meeting of the parties of the Kyoto Protocol. Thirdly, it's supposed to be the fourth major political step of international climate change negotiations. Number one was Hunstedt, 1992 in Rio. Number two was the Kyoto Protocol. And, I'm sorry, the Framework Convention, adopted in 1996. Number three, the Kyoto Protocol, adopted in 1997, ratified and come into force in 2005. And number four, hopefully, will be the outcome in Copenhagen, which hopefully will constitute another legally binding instrument. Not to be forgotten in between, however, was the result of COP7 in 2001 in Marrakesh, which was basically the adoption of all the regulations that would put the legal framework of the Kyoto Protocol into an implementable fashion. So the next thing should be Copenhagen. Now, what is the problem? The problem is multilayered, as you all know. It consists of three clearly distinguishable elements: physical problem, legal problem, political problem. If you look at the physical problem for a moment, as it presents itself to a diplomat who has to, and we should never forget that, get a hold of an issue which is dealt with by an enormous, increasing amount of scientists who, you know, rightly so, make their life in dealing with that. Now, diplomats do a lot of other things, and diplomats tend not to be scientists. That is an important thing. Very often they don't have a scientific degree. And very often, for that reason, scientific papers, as important as they are lost in space because they're not written in a way that diplomats and politicians can understand them. And if they're not written in that way, very often they're lost. So diplomats need to get hold of some facts. Some of the physical facts that they understand is that in order to stop a disaster from striking, we must, in a physical matter, limit temperature degree at an increase of 2%. Even though the disaster is, those 2% are an assumption. Nobody knows whether or not this 2% will be the threshold that we're all afraid of. The 2% were firstly introduced into discussion by the European Union. They could have said 2.5%. The islands say 1.5%, so it could be anything. But it has been a generally accepted term. 2% is it. Stabilization should also be at the level of 450 ppm. Again, that's an assumption. We don't know. But probably that's about right. We also know, as diplomats, that there's a budget. The budget of about 1,000 gigatons between now and, or between 2000 and 2050. We also know that that budget has been used by about 33% now. So, in about 8 years, 2000, 2008. So there's not much left. So for that reason, we know that we should, until 2050, reduce our emissions between 50 and 80%. Or 20 to 40% until 2020. Where, that's another information that we get in a simple way from scientists, we should reach the peak of the emissions profile. So that, given the juggernaut character of the climate as a system, we have enough breaking space so that by 2050%. There's another thing that we know, that in spite of all the efforts that have been promised, in some ways taken, in others not, by the industrialized countries, the ones, as you remember, under the Kyoto Protocol, were the ones that had to accept so-called Kelgrove's quantified emission limitation reduction objectives. Today, 50% or over 50% of the actual emissions, unfortunately, stem from sources in the developing world. That is a very important political thing that people have to remember. Now, that makes it clear that from a physical point of view, biosphere, the industrialized countries, irrespective of the fact whether or not they have done a good job under Kyoto, or Kyoto 1, cannot do the job alone. We should not make any mistake about this. Now, in addition to that, all the diplomats, of course, read all the articles in newspapers and know that if they fail, they will also be responsible for an increase of events that are outside of our control, both in a rearrangement of some physical rules, increased weather events, salination of water, rise of sea levels, and so forth, spread of diseases that have been limited so far, loss of biodiversity, disappearance of glaciers, which in turn, as a consequence of the halo effect, will increase temperatures even faster, and so forth. So these things are known. If they fail, the consequences will be bad. They also know, reading from the Pentagon and other parts, that more and more these things become a security issue. So they're spilling over from the sphere of environmental diplomacy, where they have cozily sat for 15 years, over into a more general perception of foreign policy and the threat that is felt by the defense forces, the defense establishment. Migration people, countries that are disappearing. What is going to happen to those people? Refugees. Do we know? No. There is no legal solution for citizens of countries that do no longer exist. I inquired about that just last week. There's nothing in international law. Are we going to give them a new country? Or are we going to strip their passports because the country no longer exists? These questions have not been addressed in international diplomacy. Neither have the questions of human rights. Is the right to a clean environment a human right? Not so far. It might be in your or my perception, sort of morally, but not legally. It's not there. It will have to be addressed. So that's sort of the physical, proto-legal aspect. Then there's a legal one. The Kyoto Protocol runs out in 2012. Can be argued, we could go into an argument now and say, no, it's not true, because in the Kyoto Protocol, you've got articles that refer to second and third commitment periods. But from a purely legal point of view, what has been ratified by now 190 countries,
Kyrgyzstan, and I think in Chad just joined about 2 weeks ago, is a legal instrument limiting a period 2008 to 2012. So what happens if we do not succeed in getting something further than that? Well, it's a breakdown of the system. Now, the breakdown of that system has consequences. The major one for me is the price signal that has been given for carbon. If, just assume for a second, the Kyoto Protocol is gone, the price signal will be gone. The consequences will be horrible. Because short judgment on Kyoto, the most important element of Kyoto, or one of the most important, has been to give a price signal to carbon. You give carbon a price in our society. Before that, it was not there. And then, of course, last but not least, there's a huge number of political problems involved, such as how can we put an agreement into a legal form that does not have the necessary political backing? Because in our political systems, problems are addressed that are actual and current. Do we feel climate change? Yes, a little bit. In Switzerland in 2003, we probably had about 800 people dead as a consequence of the hottest summer ever. So we feel it here and there. But it's not there yet. Our politicians are not voted into office to address issues the consequences of which will be felt 30 years down the road. That's an important one. In addition to that, other political problem. We do foreign policy to defend the interests of our country. These are immediate interests. I negotiate WTO access to a country, FTA, but not for the thing much later. Our foreign policy apparatus is not geared to that. So we must understand that we're dealing with a new global domestic policy issue, which in character is new and unique and different from all the other foreign policy issues that we know. And then, of course, another political issue is the fact that in Kyoto, we took commitments. But in order to go for the next commitments, we should be clean in terms of having met those commitments. And now I'm talking about industrialized countries like New Zealand and Switzerland. Many of the countries that have taken on a commitment in 1997 have not delivered. So we're reluctant to go for the next step and take that on. That makes Copenhagen a different one. In addition to that, as I've said before, if I need to take the commitment and I see that from now on there's a new group of countries that have not had to take commitments under the old regime, why should I be forced to take commitments that might be negative for me, my economy, my voters, my lobby groups that pressure me, and not the other guy, who, like in the case of China, is now the largest emitter. That makes it very difficult to take. Now, this brings us to one of the major issues of the political problems, and that's the relationship between the North and the South. Since 1945, and the coming into existence of a large number of former colonies as fully-fledged members of the international community, the international relations have been, in the part of sustainable development, and the environment, been clearly outlined by the fact that the North and the South were two distinguishable groups. The conference in Rio in 1992 has actually solidified that in the sense that one of the Rio principles set forth was the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities. That has meant that the North was responsible for basically all the problems in the world. It was, because they have the colonies, they have dominated. And for that reason, was liable for the cost. Whereas the South, being sort of latecomers, have the right to ask for recompensation and have the right to be supported in its development. Now that frame of mind justified as it had been in the past, does no longer reflect in its entirety the current situation. In its entirety. But in terms of diplomacy, we have not made a step beyond that. Because if you're in a situation to receive, I don't know whether you have children, and they yet, and all of a sudden you ask for responsibility, a new responsibility because the situation has changed, that's not that easy. It was my entitlement. Why should I give up my entitlement? It has served me perfectly well. So I don't want to do that. I don't want to take new commitments that until now I did not have to take. So, in addition to this, of course, negotiations are not, as you would find them described in newspapers, a representation of every country's pride on the world stage. National newspapers and media, of course, get fed by the government to give you that impression. That happens in every country. In every country. But in actual fact, that's not the way. What we see now, especially in climate change, but also in other fora, is groups that are negotiating. If you look around the table in the Kyoto area or in Copenhagen, you have the EU as a group. This environment has been given from the members of the European Union to the EU, such as economy and other things. You have the umbrella group. That's an important group, more or less circling around the United States, formed originally before Kyoto to make sure that the Kyoto mechanisms were able to be used. That is the selling and buying of that emissions reductions in individual countries at the global market. Originally, some countries were very much opposed because for moral reasons you should do reductions at home and not buy it cheaply from somewhere else. That's the umbrella group. The US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, Norway and Iceland, and Russia, Kazakhstan and Ukraine have joined later on. And then you have the G77 and China, a group of 135 developing countries. Under the leadership, of course, of the countries that can perform the role of leaders, the countries that have the human capacity, the understanding, the countries that have the interest to be in the forefront. This is a fabulous setup for a lot of poor developing countries that do not have the possibility to be present across the board in all the UN organizations and defend their interests. However, today, the G77, of course, consists in terms of climate change challenges and contributions to the problem to a great variety of various profiles. You take small island countries like Samoa or least developing countries like Guinea-Bissau in Africa. And then you have OPEC countries like Venezuela and Qatar or Saudi Arabia. And you have the big ones, Brazil, India, China. Now, the question is easy to answer. Who is calling the shots? And what interests are better taken care of within that negotiation group? I don't have to answer that question. It's obvious. So, the interests of some of the ones that probably suffer most come second to the interests of the ones that are the true leaders in that group. Now, that group, whilst it is very useful across the board, guarantees the input for the small countries, but it does not take the interests of the small countries at heart at the same time. At the same time, however, it makes sure that there is no differentiation between the various profiles of emissions in that group. And that has been one of the major stumbling blocks so far. Now, in addition, of course, if you look at the profile, you have two large countries that make up for almost half of all the emissions. 40%, let's say. China and the US. Now, every solution that we find has to bring the US and China on board. It's nice to negotiate as Switzerland in the Environmental Integrity Group, which we are, which I founded with Mexico and South Korea, which is a certain way, whereas New Zealand in the Umbrella Group, if in the solution China and the US are not there, then we're again taking only account of 60% of the emissions. Can we do that? No, because our goal is the 450 ppm and the 2 degrees. The physical goal is the overall goal. Now, confronted with all these issues, the negotiations started after the Kyoto Protocol came into force, the Marrakesh Accords came into force in 2005 in Montreal. 2007 in Bali, you must have heard of that, there was the Bali Plan of Action. Bali Action Plan, great. Great step forward. Everybody applauded, everybody sort of slapped themselves on the shoulder. We made the breakthrough. We even brought the US in. Fabulous. But there was no legal commitment. There was just a lot of hype and important steps forward. No legal commitment. Ever since then, between 2007 and now, in this Bali Plan of Action, negotiations have gone on. Have gone on. And there's a lot of different problems into which I will not go here. The major problems that came out were two: mitigation and finance. Now, in mitigation, there were two tracks. One was the ad hoc working group on further commitments for Annex 1 parties under the Kyoto Protocol. For all parties, was the ad hoc working group on long-term cooperative action under the convention. Sounds very complicated. Why is that? Exactly for the reason that I mentioned before. It was not, and remains not to be, in the interest of the developing countries, as it is perceived until now, to bring a discussion together which would take the firewall away which exists between them and the developed countries. That's why we have these two tracks. Many countries in the process of negotiations since 2007, many industrialized countries, with interesting attempts, have tried to bridge or climb over or duck under or circumvent that firewall that exists between the so-called Annex 1 and non-Annex 1 countries, in order to address the physical issue. There are proposals on the table by Australia. There are proposals on the table by the United States. There are other proposals. There are proposals to bring in countries into the system that have not been in there. To no avail. To no avail. The problem is, and that's the major snag right here, developed industrialized countries will not pay for mitigation and adaptation measures in developing countries under a Kyoto deal unless there are mitigation commitments. Actions. I'm a bit cautious to use the word commitment because they might look differently. Of the large developing country emitters, large in terms of emissions, either in a global term or in per capita terms. Even smaller developing countries have, you know, large per capita emissions, like some smaller industrialized countries have larger per capita emissions, others have smaller ones. So that is where we are right now. That is where we are. We have the need for financing for action in developing countries. And that financing has to come from the north. But in return, there is a need for the world, the north, to see action on part of large developing country interests. Nobody's talking about the small islands. Nobody's talking about the Chads and the Guinea-Bissaus of the sort. Their contribution, either to the problem, nor to the solution, is negligible. That is not the problem. The problem is the other. Now, that is how we're facing it. If you look at the two large groups, and there's lots of crisscrosses between, but the two large groups facing off, and Copenhagen in 2 weeks, you have a number of conditions for a deal. Developing countries, they want the firewall to continue. They want two agreements. A second Kyoto commitment period with clear railroads for industrialized countries along the lines of Kyoto 1. They want no legally binding mitigation commitments for developing countries. Irrespective of the fact, and now you want to be clearly understood here, that many of the developing countries, including Brazil, China, even India, have plans in place and undertake measures to actually address the issue. But they don't want that to be part of an obligation. They want to be the masters of their own destiny and not being at a level playing field with the industrialized country. And then, and that is important for the morale of the group, and also for the protection of some, of course, of the larger leaders, they do not want any differentiation of the developing countries. Because it's clear, a lot of the northern negotiators looked at the profiles and said, we need to go beyond this group thing. That's a thing of the past. We need to look at emissions. What is the profile in country X? Now, country X is together with country Y when it comes to emissions in industrialized countries. If you look at the highest per capita emission in the world, that's a developing country. It's Qatar, 56 tons. Huge. Understandable, somebody could come in and say, you know, these poor guys, they're producing a lot of gas. That's true. But that's a system imminent thing. Until now, emissions reductions are caught at the source and not at the place of usage. That could be negotiated, talked about, but currently as the system stands, it is at the source. So for the Chinese, for the Saudis, for the Indians, of course, they do not want to be separated from Guinea-Bissau and Samoa, because they want to maintain that system of the G77. For the small countries who might benefit less, they know, of course, that the system of the G77 is something which is overarching. And they could not afford to leave it, because they might be punished, not actively, but just by being cut loose from an important stream of information in New York, in a lot of other fields, when it comes to important access to funds under UNDP, for example. You wouldn't want to do that. If I was a representative of an African developing country, I would not want to split from the G77. It would not be in my interest. But it might be in my interest here to take a more liberal stance. So one of the discussions always ongoing, especially among northern diplomats, is will we be successful to split off our AOCs, the Association of Small Island States, or the African group, or the least developing country group, because it must be in their interest to understand that the Saudi proposal will be very, very negative for them in the long run. How can they support Saudi Arabia? That's the reason, because they just have no other option. So these things stand there on part of the developing countries. Now, part of the developed countries, you have the other thing waiting 2 weeks from now. They want one agreement. Because now, as I said, bring down the firewall. We have to address the issue. The issue is we need to be flexible in terms of addressing the overall physical challenge. We need to bring everybody on board, the large developing countries, not the Guinea-Bissau and Samoa of this world, but we need the Chinese, we need the Saudis, we need the Brazilians, they need to be part of that. Now, we are maybe ready to accept kenros. But that is also what Muzidin says. We need to know the rules first. How can we accept a kenros if we don't know the rules? Let me give you a little anecdote. In 1997, we negotiated for 3 days on end. You could take the floor to speak about something. It was completely wrong. Nobody would notice. You know, after 3 days of negotiation, you were through. So what happened was, when there was an impasse, the president of the negotiations was the Argentinian ambassador to China. He would come after 2 weeks with a bunch of little pieces of papers. And he would walk around and give to every country head of delegation of the industrialized countries a little piece of paper. And on that piece of paper was your papers. And he would say, you take it or leave it. If you leave it, you'll break consensus. And you can stay here for nothing else. So by this threat, he succeeded alone in giving all of us the kettles. The kettles were good. I mean, it was not crazy. It was after lengthy negotiations, he knew what people were willing to accept. But that is impossible because science and knowledge has proceeded. In Kyoto, about halfway through, I had to call my guys back home and say, Zinks, what is that? You know, what can you give me something? And they, Zinks, well, that's the tree thing. And they sort of took out the calculators in the process. Today we're way beyond that. Way. So these things are no longer possible. It's fair by the Brazilian delegation to say before we accept the campos, we want to know the rules. Before we go out there and play with the ball, where do we have to put the ball? Is that the ball or where do we do it? That makes sense. So, but that's a catch-22 situation. Do you want to have the rules or do you want to have the ball? It's not that easy. In Barcelona, a few weeks ago, the African delegations walked out because they said, we want the kenros first and then the rules. Of course, that was impossible. But it highlighted a situation that they said, you in the north, rightly so, I have to say, you have to take the lead. You have to give us your own kenros. And of course, they were right. Let me put on a G77 hat for a moment, if I may, with the indulgence of my colleague from Singapore. It is, of course, a bit awkward if you look at the numbers and how they were delivered by the Annex I countries over the first commitment period. We're not really there when it comes to actual results. Some countries are there, like mine, but it's easier for us because we have a lot of hydro and we have a lot of electrical trains, it's a bit easier than for others who depend on, you know, fossil fuel power stations. So we didn't deliver. Of course, the US, very conveniently, they're very often put in the same bed with us. You know, G77 can say, you guys didn't deliver, as if we were responsible for the US not being there. But after all, they're part of Annex I and they were part of the overall deal. Now, if we look at the numbers that have been put on the table by a number of countries of Annex I, industrialized countries, they don't look very good. They don't look very good. Some of the countries came up to the EU, and I would like to comment the EU on that. Very early on, we said, we're going to do minus 20. We're going to do minus 30 if there are others out there. Other countries were a bit dragging their feet. The US may be coming up in Copenhagen with minus 17. If the president will travel to Copenhagen, that's still uncertain. It would be a good sign. I just read this morning a very smart sentence where somebody said, when the president comes, the US will give something. When the foreign minister comes, the US wants something. So if the president comes, that's a good sign. So now, in addition to that, to just conclude the industrialized countries, the industrialized countries are in a recession. Before the delegations travel to Copenhagen, they will have a hard time at home. Because the finance ministers will say, you want to go pay money? For what? for a problem in 2050? No. But that's part of the deal. If they cannot show up with the funds ready to sort of bring non-industrialized countries to the table, to the overall deal, you are ready to take commitments, we are ready to finance the tech transfer that will enable you to do what you need to do under your commitments. So we want you to be in the deal and we'll pay for it. If we just want you to be in the deal, but unfortunately we can't pay because our finance minister didn't give us the money, nothing will happen. So that's important. Will it be possible? It's interesting to say, just as an observer in New Zealand, I have not seen much of a discussion about the funds that will be necessary for New Zealand to put on the table. And I'm not talking about the purchase of CERs to be in commitment. I'm just talking about paying the developing countries to be part of the deal, you know, upfront. That discussion, that's nothing to do with New Zealand. That's a discussion everybody tiptoes around a little bit in the north. Will it happen? I'm not sure. It must happen. Without that, we need to be able to show something for our demands towards the developing world to be part of this. Honestly, in my opinion, this is a justified approach. It's justified that the large emitters contribute. But it's also justified on their part to say, okay, but you need to help us financially. Now, what is the likely outcome in Copenhagen? And that's my fourth and last one. Given the vast differences between major groups 2 weeks before Copenhagen, 3 weeks before Copenhagen, a breakthrough deal seems to be unlikely. What would that mean? A breakthrough deal would mean three things. It would have to be ambitious, it would have to be legally binding, and it would also have to be acceptable politically for everyone. That seems to be unlikely. So what will we have? Will we have the total breakdown where people say, look, I'm not going to buy this car. It was nice meeting you, goodbye. I don't think that will happen either. Who would be willing to take the blame in a situation like that? The U.S.? You know, would the new Obama administration be ready to say, no, the deal was not right, we walked away? Other industrialized countries? The EU? I don't think so. Because political pressure in the EU and in other countries of Europe is such that we must clinch a deal. It's important, it has to be realized by the population. They want a deal. So would they break away? China, you're not part of it? All right. You had a chance for walking away? No. The G77? As a whole? No. Definitely not the small countries. Look at AOSIS coming out very strongly all the time. Would they walk away? You say 2 degrees, we say 1.5. That's unacceptable. We walk? No. Least developed countries? Who will suffer the most if we don't get a deal? The Africans? Definitely not. The large developing countries? Or OPEC, the culprits? Who are the ones that do not want us to decarbonize? Aha, we always knew it was them. They walk away? No. With the Chinese, who've actually introduced interesting programs to decarbonize their society, they have to, because the cost of pollution in China is skyrocketing. In their own interest, will they walk away? Yeah. But, so nobody will walk away. So that option is off the table. The legally binding option, in 2 weeks, to break this impasse, bring the firewall down, there are no diggers as large that would bring that firewall down now. That firewall can only be chewed away by people that spent their lives in these you know, artificially lit negotiation halls. And that will not be the case. It's too late for that. I stand to be corrected, and I would be the most joyful if I was wrong. If a phoenix would sort it out on the last night. Because usually what happens is, in the room, it's like a spaceship. you go out, you forget about the world. There's Greenpeace dancing out there, they're up on cranes, and they give you things, but it does not really sink through, because you're in there, and you have your documents, and you negotiate, and you're in drafting groups, and then you have your ministers coming in. Some of the countries love it when their ministers come, because some of the ministers are, and let's be very frank, absolutely on top of the reef. And they can make the difference, and I have seen that. They can cut through the red tape. But unfortunately, ministers are people like you and me. And very often they were made minister and put there and don't even understand what's going on. And then, and there's the sinister, sinister tendency of bureaucrats to sideline their ministers. Why don't you go, you know, beautiful city? Have you seen the Arts Museum? And they don't dare to break out of their own reef. And some of the countries are very clever in making sure that a minister would not say anything that has not been picked up by the bureaucrats. So, is it safe to say they will do it at the end of Copenhagen? I'm not sure. I would be happy, as I said, I would be happy, and it's not impossible. Maybe it will be done. I don't think so. Given the fact that the U.S. Senate has not decided, the Americans might be there with some good ideas, good impact, but they cannot legally deliver. Now, as long as they cannot legally deliver, the others will not be able to legally deliver. I'm from China. How can I go home and say, yes, you know, we had a good deal, and my boss will tell me, but the Senate? What about the Americans? They will take a decision, generally. How can you sell us down the drain in December? So what will probably happen is the third option, which has been already put on the table, because you don't want to make it look like a non-success. So it has to be a success. It cannot be a great success, but it can be a success. Very important difference. Every, you know, presence at the conference has to be a success by definition. Otherwise, taxpayers would say, why do we spend the money? These guys are traveling there. In the media, you know, back home, you have to sell these things as a success. And it will probably can be a success, in the sense that the third option is most likely. We will not get a legally binding solution. We might get a repetition of body, where we restate our shared view. That's a good example. It might go a bit beyond that, where we say, yes, we will enter into commitments. Yes, we will come up with the necessary financial means. And unfortunately, it takes us a bit longer to reach an outcome. There might be, until COP16 in Mexico City, the year from now, a COP15 bis. We had it in the past, COP6 and COP6 bis in 2000. So this might happen again. In order to try to find a solution which will accommodate everyone, and hopefully also the atmosphere. That's not true. Thank you very much.